Maybe some of you have had, as mothers, have had a wonderful relationship with your daughters, and you could say, in many ways, they've been my best friend. I know my daughter growing up, that relationship with my wife that was very close, and actually my wife had a great relationship with my mom. We lived with my parents for a few years, and as we were exploring ministry and where God would lead us, and she had almost a best friend type of relationship with my mom. And so it's wonderful when you can have that relationship with a mom. My mom was my best friend too in many ways, and my dad as well, but obviously we're honoring moms today too. So had a wonderful relationship with my mom. So, but today we're not looking at a text about mothers, but we're looking at a text between two men and who had a friend relationship. And we're going to see that here in 1 Samuel chapter 18, verses 1 through 16. Now, in chapters 18 through 20, we see David's service in Saul's court. J. Carl Laney makes an important observation here, and he writes, "The story is told in terms of the relationship between David and Jonathan. It is the author's purpose to show that the very man David displaced," you get that? "He displaced Jonathan in succession to the throne was his best friend." Don't let that pass over you. This is not just, oh, a nice story of friendship. It's far beyond that. Because it's showing here that Jonathan displaced in succession. Remember, it was Jonathan's throne to take because Saul was a king, okay? But that isn't what was going to happen. But he goes on. "The very man David displaced in succession to the throne was his best friend. And that Saul's own son acknowledged the legitimacy of David's rule." So there is a purpose for this text. It's not just, oh, let me give you a nice story about a friendship between David and Jonathan. No. He is establishing the fact that David is the legitimate king of Israel, and even Jonathan, Saul's son, admitted it. So this is significant. We need to keep this in mind. So it's not just a wonderful story of friendship. It is, okay? But if you only see it that way, you miss the point, okay? Because the author is trying to bring across the fact that David is the legitimate king of Israel. He is the one who was anointed, and he is the king. Furthermore, Eugene Merrill wrote concerning verses 1 through 7 that, quote, "David, as has been seen, was not only chosen from eternity to be the founder of the messianic dynasty of kings, but he was also providentially prepared by the Lord to undertake his royal responsibilities." Now, again, this is important. Remember, Christ was in David's line. The promise was made to David of someone to sit on the Davidic throne forever. So how important is the fact that Jonathan acknowledges David as king, who was the legitimate heir of the throne? It's very significant. But notice what he says here, Merrill, at the end, prepared by the Lord to undertake his royal responsibilities. We see that too. David, he goes on, "David had served as a shepherd in the fields and had the loving, protective heart of a shepherd, a fitting attribute of a king." Is not our Christ the king and the shepherd? Absolutely. He had learned responsibility and courage by confronting and slaying wild beasts that threatened his flock, chapter 17. He had learned to play the harp, a skill that would make him sensitive to the aesthetic side of life and that would help him compose the stirring psalms which extol the Lord and celebrate his mighty exploits. How important was it that he played the harp? Well, the book of Psalms tells us how important that is. He didn't write all of the Psalms, but a lot of them. David had been brought into the palace of the king as musician and warrior so that he might acquire the experience of statecraft. You get that? Though an uninitiated novice at the beginning of his anointing, he was eminently equipped to be king of Israel at his coronation some 15 years later. He went to school for 15 years, also called the School of Hard Knocks, okay? But his education was not always pleasant. With his rising popularity among the people came a deterioration of his relationship with Saul, for the king became insanely jealous of Israel's new hero. So first of all, then, we see an incredible friendship and covenant, an incredible friendship and covenant in verses 1 through 4. Let's go ahead and begin by reading those four verses. Now it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the son of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David, and his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. Again, this is all very significant. We'll mention it when we get there. Notice verse 1, it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul. So after the confrontation with Goliath and his conversation with Saul, David's relationship with the royal family changed dramatically. One change, and of course we know that he married Saul's daughter and that sort of thing. We understand that. Saul promised all of these things. But one change here was Saul's relationship to Saul's son, Jonathan. That is the big change that's mentioned here. And it said the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. In other words, they were immediately bound together in a deep friendship love. Jonathan loved him as himself, or literally the Hebrew says, became one in spirit with. Or even more literally here, spirit bound with spirit. Spirit bound with spirit. Now, to make this any more than the deep love of friendship is absurd. And some people do. They try to say, oh, David and Jonathan were homosexuals. See, there we have it. And I've heard this kind of nonsense. But that's not what the text is saying. And that's not the point of all of this. Some have read this into the text that David must have had a homosexual relationship with Jonathan. No, folks, this is the love of friendship. You know, isn't it a shame that our society today has lost the idea of friendship and instead everything's about sex? We do. Just to be honest, that is what our society is like today. And if you have a friendship with anybody, you know, it's like, oh, are you guys a little, you know, is that it? Are you gay? But we can't even have friendships anymore without people saying, oh, they must be homosexuals. But understand that this word that's used here is never used of an unnatural relationship of homosexuality. Never would it said they were bound together as homosexuals or anything of that sort. No way. In fact, the Bible plainly condemns homosexuality in no uncertain terms and would never speak of it in a positive sense. And nothing's negative here about this. So what drew Jonathan to David? Look here for a moment in this book. 1 Samuel 14, just for a minute. Back up just a minute, and let's just review a moment. 1 Samuel 14. Do you remember what happened here? 1 Samuel 14, verses 1 through 15. Remember Jonathan and his armor bearer? Let's go get him. Lord, you know, you do this, and if they ask this, then I'm going to go after them. God caused it to be. He said, fine. Climbed up to get them. Come on up, get us, you know. And so Jonathan climbs up and he slays a bunch of these soldiers. He and his armor bearer. Would he miss the armor bearer God? And I mean, an amazing thing. This is, in a sense, similar to David and Goliath. Very similar. Can you see maybe why the hearts of them were knit together? They were both individuals that trusted God implicitly and were willing in boldness to step out in faith. What drew Jonathan to David? Well, I think this is part of it. And Jonathan saw in David a reflection of himself. I would have done it too. Jonathan, in many ways, then saw a reflection of himself in David. Jonathan found in David a man who was as committed to trusting and obeying God as he was. They say that opposites attract, and in some cases that may be, but when it comes to believers, likes attract. Okay? Committed believers, committed Christians are going to be attracted to each other. By the way, carnal Christians and children of the devil will also be attracted to each other since they have things in common too. But real believers who are committed to Jesus Christ are going to be attracted to real believers committed to Jesus Christ. You know, if you have a problem with other committed believers, you need to examine your heart. There's a problem. I've known some believers that just didn't like church, didn't like coming to church, didn't like to hear, you know, other believers talk about God and all. I'm kind of a private person. Why? Why would you not want to hear other believers to be encouraged by them? There's something very seriously wrong. First of all, do you know the Lord? Or have you been fooling yourself? Number two, if you do, you must not be walking with the Lord very, very closely if you have an attitude like that. You see, because committed Christians are attracted to each other. How about you? Who are your best friends? Committed Christians, carnal Christians, unbelievers. Well, I like unbelievers. There's a lot of hypocrites among Christians, and I'd rather be with unbelievers. There's a problem, folks. If that's what you're thinking, there's a problem. You don't understand. Do Christians have problems? Yeah, and guess what? You and I do too. All of us have problems. All of us have sins we struggle with, right? And to say that, well, you know, they're all a bunch of hypocrites, but I'm willing to, you know, hang out with this person that, you know, is on drugs and, you know, cusses and drinks and does other things and, you know, whatever they may do. I'm willing to do that, but I'm not willing to spend time with believers because they have problems. It doesn't make any sense. There is a problem with the heart in that case. You know, you could tell much about a person by their friends. Not only that, you could tell a lot about a person by their enemies too. People who are not committed Christians, if you know Christ, if you're following him, they're not going to like you. Okay. You make them feel uncomfortable. In fact, they'll look at you, oh, you think you're better than everybody else. No, it's got nothing to do with that. People misunderstand. They feel uncomfortable because when you walk with Christ, it's going to make people feel awkward and uncomfortable. Did Paul's relationship with Jesus make other people uncomfortable? Yeah. Oh, Paul there was always, you know, stirring up a riot everywhere he went. His relationship with Jesus made the Jews really upset with him, and Gentiles too. So if you are embraced by the enemies of Christ, you have a problem. You have a problem. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't have a relationship with unsaved people in order to see them come to know the Lord. That's not what I'm saying. But if your best friends are unsaved people, there's a problem. If you cherish and want to be with unsaved people all the time, there's a problem. So I'm not saying don't have acquaintances, unsafe friends, because otherwise, how are you going to witness to them, right? So you want to have unsafe friends, but you don't want to become so friendly with them that you become like them, because they'll rub off. Evil companions, Scripture says, corrupt good morals. And it's absolutely true. Look at John chapter 13 just for a moment. Keep your finger here. John chapter 13. John chapter 13 and verse 34. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Let me ask you a question. Are you one of his disciples? And by that I mean, are you a follower of Jesus Christ? All men will know you're my disciples if you have love one for another. You know, there's that old Christian song, they'll know we are Christians by our love. And what was it, the first century soldier that said of Christians, behold how they love one another. Behold how they love one another. It impressed him that Christians were bound as family. They loved one another and they showed it. And folks, again, your best friends ought to be believers. I'm not saying don't ever be friends with unsaved people. That's not what I'm saying. But your best friends, your most intimate, closest friends, ought to be like you spiritually. This is the relationship between David and Jonathan. Not some homosexual relationship, not some disgusting, horrible thing. Notice verse 2. Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. So apparently, Saul responded to both his son's affection for David and David's bravery by keeping him close within the royal household. Saul and Jonathan both dearly loved David, although Saul's demonic jealousy would soon be very evident in all of this. Verse 3, then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. So Jonathan's love for David inspired him to make a covenant, a promise with David. Moreover, in this covenant, there seems to be a realization of God's will for David's life as per Samuel's prophecy, 1 Samuel 23, verse 17. And we'll see that in the next verse. Look at 1 Samuel 23, 17, just for a moment. Chapter 23, verse 17. Notice what it says. Thus he said to him, do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul my father will not find you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you, and Saul my father knows that also. There's a realization, David, you are God's anointed one, okay? There is a realization of that. And what Samuel had said, they took it to heart. All right, notice verse 4. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David and his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. Was this just a nice gift? Let me just give you some gifts here. You can have my own robe on me. All right? There's more to this act than most people think, okay? When Jonathan took off his robe, by the way, that was a symbol of his power and authority as Saul's son, as the next in line. So when Jonathan took off his robe and gave it to David, it was symbolic of transferring his own status as heir apparent to him. You are God's anointed, not me. Also notice that this covenant of friendship was a unilateral covenant in which Jonathan committed himself to David with complete disregard for himself. The gifts served to ratify that covenant. So here's the promise I'm making. Here's what I'm giving you to ratify that covenant. Real friendship here, folks. Jonathan's humility here is even more remarkable when we consider that he very well, get this now, he very well may have been some 30 years older than David. Let that sink in. Really difficult sometimes for an older person in line for the throne is submitting to a man who is 30 years younger than he is. This is really remarkable. And it shows the kind of character that Jonathan had. Notice an awful jealousy and fear. So the first point we saw was in verses 1 through 4, an incredible friendship and covenant. Indeed it is. But notice verses 5 through 11, an awful jealousy and fear. Verse 5. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered. And Saul set him over the men of war. And it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. It happened as they were coming when David returned from killing the Philistine that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. The women sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And you can picture Saul saying, what are they saying? They're saying, what? Oh, this grates on him. Then Saul became very angry for this saying displeased him. Oh, I bet it did. And he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s. But to me, they have ascribed thousands. Now, what more can he have but the kingdom? Well, he would. Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. Here's the pivotal point in 1 Samuel. Now, it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house while David was playing the harp with his hand as usual, and a spear was in Saul's hand. Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall, not by his clothes. But David escaped from his presence twice. And that's significant too. So notice verse 5. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered, and Saul set him over the men of war, and it was pleasing in the sight of all the people, meaning the army, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Although Saul may or may not have known that Samuel anointed David, it seems to be David's success and popularity that absolutely grate upon Saul. I rather think he did know. But this grates on him. And we'll see that more in the next message. Obviously, God's blessing was upon obedient David. By God's grace, he was successful in his exploits. Wherever Saul sent him, he was successful. And then, you know, comes to verse 6, and of course the people loved him. Okay. God had given a real love to the people and the military in particular who went out with him, a real love for David and a respect for him. And notice it says, as they were coming, David returned from killing the Philistine. Okay, this is with David and Goliath. That the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to make King Saul with them with tambourines. Now, we think a tambourine with little, shaky things on it, whatever you call those little cymbals, and, you shake it. This is a little bit different. It may be something somewhat similar. This is more like a small drum than anything else, this idea of a tambourine, so small drums. David's success, and thus King Saul's success in killing Goliath, which resulted in the defeat of the Philistines, was met with music, it was met with jubilation, it was met with joy. And as the army returned, the women, the mothers, the daughters, the wives, came out of the cities to meet the men with joyful music and dancing. And we think dancing, it wasn't some sensual. People get the idea, oh, this supports dancing. I can go out and I could dance and, shake my body. Come on. You really think that's what they were doing here? It's more like jumping up and down. You've been to a sports game and you jump up, you get excited. This is the kind of thing. They were excited about winning. They were excited about what God had done. So it was joyful music and dancing. They were jumping around with joy. We won't say much more about the dancing here at this point, but honestly, if anyone uses this as a proof text to justify the sensual dance of the world, going to a prom, that sort of thing, you're sadly mistaken. Sadly mistaken. To compare sensual dance with the expressions of jubilation following a victory in battle is patently absurd. It's absurd. We'll say more about it another time, all right? So it said musical instruments. This one word in the Hebrew is a derivative of the word for three and probably refers to some sort of three-sided or three-stringed instrument of some sort anyhow. But, you know, we don't know about all of the instruments they may have had at this time. And, well, they may have created some that we don't know about. We know about a lot of different things, but that we don't. Notice verse 7. The women sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. It was customary in ancient Israel for the women to write lyrics to memorialize the successes of the men in military conflict. So that's what they're doing. It was a customary thing. And so the lyrics they wrote were disturbing to Saul. Saul has slain his thousands. And I'm sure he's thinking, it's about me. And David is 10,000s. And then suddenly it's, oh. It goes from oh to oh my. The fact that David is a more successful warrior than Saul is now immortalized in a song. And as we see in the verses to come, this grates on Saul. It is terrible. And so in verse 8, it says he was very angry. And there's the idea here of burning behind this Hebrew word. Saul was hot with anger. Ever had someone pile honor on a person instead of you? And maybe you thought you deserved it? It can be particularly difficult when that person is the new kid on the block. And a kid, and you're an adult maybe. Ungodly people like Saul are prone to jealousy, whereas those who walk with the Lord are not as prone. And I would point out once again, Jonathan, okay? And the same can be applied to us. Jealousy is for the immature. Jealousy is for the immature. We've got to be careful of that, don't we? We need to walk with the Lord. If we maintain the attitude found in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3, it will help. The Net Bible translates that verse, instead of being motivated by selfish ambition or vanity, each of you should, in humility, be moved to treat one another as more important than yourself. This is what we need to do as believers. That would totally get rid of any jealousy, any competition that one Christian might have with another. We look at other people as more important than ourselves. It's not me. It's not my pride. It's not what I do. No, I look at you and I say, you're more important than I am. See, that's how Jonathan looked at David. Their soul was knit together. He was as important as himself. And then, of course, Saul makes a statement, what more can he have but the kingdom? He has the people's hearts. Now, you know, what more can he have than the throne itself? And perhaps Saul thinks back to Samuel's prophecy, chapter 15. Could be. Verse 9. Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. This verse, as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, it shows the big transition in Saul's attitude toward David from respect and love to jealousy and suspicion. Isn't it amazing how a person's attitude can change on a dime? And it can. A person's attitude can change on a dime. They can go from being a cherished person to the devil himself. And that's what happened with Saul. This has happened to me as a pastor through the years. We had a couple that was we discipled. They became good friends of ours. They would watch Heather when she was a young child, a baby, and a young child babysit once in a while. Had a good relationship. I was their pastor. The wife looked at me and said, "Pastor, if we ever slip away from the Lord, please let us know." And I said, "I will. I will." Guess what? That day happened. I fulfilled my promise. And I said, "You told me to tell you. I'm telling you now, you slipped away from the Lord." Well, this couple ended up getting a divorce. Just made a mess of their lives. Real mess. And, you know, they went from being, "Pastor, we love you," to, "I was now the enemy." And what a shame it was. Then they started talking about me to someone else in the church. Stuff that wasn't true. "Do you realize what the pastor said to me?" They didn't realize I was fulfilling a promise. I was fulfilling a promise. They said, "Let us know if we..." And I did. I did. So it happens, doesn't it? That people's emotions can turn on a dime. And this is exactly what happened with Saul here. Notice, too, that David did nothing to deserve it. And sometimes, folks, we do nothing to deserve the treatment we get. But that's all right. We just need to trust God. God will work those things out. Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. The NIV, the old NIV, translates it this way. And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. That's exactly what it was. He was jealous of him. He thinks he's going to be the king. Well, he would be. Oh, he thinks he's somebody special. Everybody's giving him honors. I'm the king. How dare he be that way? Saul kept a jealous eye on David. Verse 10. And it came about on the next day, an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house while David was playing the harp with his hand as usual, and a spear was in Saul's hand. Evil spirit from God came mightily upon him. Another translation says this: an evil spirit from God came forcefully upon Saul. Or another one says, an evil spirit from God rushed upon Saul. As we said in an earlier message about this, I believe that God in his sovereignty and with his hand of discipline appointed a demon to terrorize Saul. And once again, he sends the demon once again to terrorize Saul because of his rotten attitude toward his anointed, David. So here we see that demon once again. And notice it says, and he raved. The King James and other translations beside the King James use the term prophesied. And he prophesied in the midst of the house. Well, is it raved or is it prophesied? Well, it's both. The idea of the Hebrew word here in this context is probably to exhibit the behavior of a prophet coupled with the idea of to be in rage. So he's babbling these things that the demon is obviously inspired, probably in some kind of raging trance-type state caused by the demon. And then it said David was playing the harp with his hand as usual. David is once again employed to play the harp for Saul to calm him down, but this time the results are different. There's a contrast in the Hebrew concerning what each man, by the way, had in his hand. One had a spear, one had a harp. Interesting how it contrasts that here in the text. Verse 11. Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall," but David escaped from the presence twice. Notice that David avoided the spear twice. I brought that to your attention before. Saul thought that David might act disloyally, but the fact that he continued to try to help him even after the first try, shows David's amazing loyalty to Saul. After the first time, I would have run out of the room. How about you? He stayed for another one. David had the spear thrown at him by Saul, dodged it, and then it was retrieved by Saul, and he threw it again at him, and he dodged it the second time. Loyalty. Loyalty to the one, and he wasn't going to raise up his hand against God's anointed. I realize God had now changed who was his anointed here, but according to David, I still have to respect this man. He's still the king of Israel, and he was. And then in verses 12 through 16, a growing fright and love. Let's look at this quickly. Now Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him but had departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as his commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. When Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and came in before them. Saul was now, notice, afraid of David. This is a striking statement. After what just happened, we would expect to hear, David was scared of Saul. You just had a spear thrown at you twice, and you dodged it. Wouldn't you be afraid? But that's not what the text says. It says Saul was afraid. Perhaps part of the reason Saul was afraid is he didn't pin him to the wall either time. Here he is, he's scared of David. And why? For the Lord was with him because he departed from Saul. This was apparently obvious to Saul because David was able to dodge his spear, and this frightened Saul. The prophecy would come true. One afraid, one not. The difference? The presence of the Lord. The presence of God, folks, dispels fear. We see that throughout the scriptures. Surely I will be with you, he said to Moses. He said to Joshua, I'm going to be with you wherever you go. Folks, we need to understand and believe the fact that God is with us today wherever we go. We have the permanent indwelling of the Holy Spirit. We shouldn't be afraid. We have His presence with us. We need to be controlled by Him, by the Holy Spirit, to experience His ministry to us. And Saul's fear led to what he did next in verse 13. He's scared. Removed him from his presence and appointed him as his commander of 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. David no longer served in Saul's court. He's scared. Saul sought to remove him from the protective confines of the royal residence, and as a young and inexperienced officer, hopefully David would be killed in battle. We find out that just the opposite happened. Why? Because the presence of God had departed from Saul and now was with David. And it says he went out and came in before the people. One translation says David led the army out to battle and back. That's what it means. He led the army out to battle and came back again. Everything's great. Verse 14, again, just the opposite happened with David. He was injured? No, he was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. There's the key. The Lord was with him. Saul wanted him dead, but instead David prospered. Prospered, why? Because God was with him. And if God is with us, we can prosper in our ways spiritually. And the unexpected result elicited here a reaction from Saul in verse 15. And it says what? When Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, instead of being killed, instead of being injured, whatever, he dreaded him. The root of this word dreaded means to be intimidated before a stronger or superior being or thing. It's used of fear toward men, animals, and God. Imagine coming up out here, and we have bear around here. Imagine stepping out and walking up to a big black bear. That'd be intimidating, wouldn't it? You better believe it, that'd be intimidating. That's the same kind of thing. He dreaded him. He dreaded him. One translation says fearful awe. He had a fearful awe for him. Verse 16. But all Israel and Judah loved David. And he went out and came in before them. In other words, he led them in their campaigns in and out. Saul thought he would take care of the problem, but the situation only got worse. Why? Because God was with David and was not with Saul. Look where unbelief and rebellion led Saul. Doing his own thing. Folks, doing our own thing, not obeying God, will lead us the same place, and that is failure. Every single time. Every single time. Walk with God. Walk with God. We say, well, I'm going to do it my way. Yeah, Saul tried that. How did that work out for him? Rebelling against God, doing his own thing. And then getting angry when he was judged by God. Denying it. Denying that he was under the judgment of God. Shame on Saul. But yet David intimately loved God. And David and Jonathan intimately loved each other as friends. Folks, as we close our message today, let me ask a couple of things. Number one, are you born again? If you died today, are you 100% sure that you'd go to heaven? If not, today place your personal faith in Jesus Christ as your Savior from sin. Won't you do that right now if you never had before? Number two, if you know Him as Savior and are not walking with Him today, maybe as a mom or a kid or a husband, doesn't matter who you are, won't you walk with Him? Won't you walk with Him? As we looked at the life here of David and Jonathan, godly men, let's imitate them, not imitate the disobedience and rebellion of Saul.